My name is Bruce Berner, and this is my first time at Holden, and this is the first class I'm teaching. So I'm counting on all of you to help here, because part of what my research interest is currently is how the general population reacts to the criminal justice system, what they think about it. So you may think I'm teaching. I'm actually here gathering research for some articles on the way the public views the criminal justice system. I teach at the law school at Valparaiso University in Indiana. And I'm a lawyer, and one person has already admitted to hating lawyers. I'm sure there's a whole lot more who do, but won't probably admit it. So thank you for your candor. Anyway. What I'm going to be talking about over the next 2 weeks, and I'm here for 2 weeks, is what we do about people who hurt other people. And essentially, that concerns two different processes. One of them we think of as the criminal system, and we usually associate that with a more serious kind of behavior. And then the other we call the tort system or the accident system, and I'll be talking about some of that this week, but mostly this week I want to talk about the criminal justice system. I want to spend just about 10 minutes here at the beginning just laying out some basic ideas about how I see the system working. And then I want to open it up and hear from you. Again, an interest of mine now is finding out how people outside the system perceive it, what they see its weaknesses as, what they see its strengths as. The criminal justice system is really three different systems all amalgamated together. And I've put a little ellipse drawing here on the board to help you. We start with the process that we think of in association with police, which is a kind of an investigative police administrative system. That's part of the criminal justice system, although it's not what we think of first. But at the investigative level, unless things can come to the attention of the formal process, it won't have anything to work with. Then the formal judicial system, probably what we think about when we say the criminal justice system, we think of courts. And so we'll talk a little bit about today about how they approach the problem. And then corrections. That is, if there is a conviction and if there is a sentence to be implemented, the corrections process is the system that delivers that. And we won't talk too much about that unless you're interested in it. If you have particular questions or comments on the way the correction system works, I'd like to talk about them too. I am not going to go down the steps in the process that I have on the blue sheet. That may be something which will spark some questions if you have them. I want to start by just talking about what the system is supposed to do and what it is, for the most part, pretty good at doing. And then I want to talk about some other things that the system was never designed to do, but which many people think it ought to be doing. And I want you then to see whether your objections to the process, assuming you have any, are really based on things that you assume the system is supposed to be doing, but that the system really isn't designed to do and can't unless we change it. If you want to, I certainly won't object. If you want to, in your questions, address O.J. Simpson. It was hard over the last year in law school to get through a class period where somebody didn't have one kind of a question or another about what was going on there. Everything else you can say about televising criminal trials, in my mind, was outweighed by the amount of exposure and natural interest that the case had for everybody. I think whether you found the experience positive or negative, it was certainly educational for those people who followed it, either the people who got addicted to it, and I had some friends, and Deanne knows who some of them are, who just got so addicted to that they couldn't do anything but watch it. When they began to miss classes they were supposed to teach, we got a little cross with them. And others who just kind of, as I did, followed it. Generally, I would look at the news clips each day. And that, by the way, creates its own problem. Because the jury heard one case, And most people who followed it kind of casually heard a totally different case. Because you'd hear all the things that the jury wasn't allowed to hear. And you weren't hanging around when they heard all the boring stuff that was happening during the middle of the day. Right? So that's why we each got a different picture of it. Two things that the system is supposed to do, and when I talk about the system here, I mean an individual criminal case coming through the system. Not the legislature sitting down and deciding what the laws should be, but assuming that we've got a body of law sitting there, rules to follow, how does each individual dispute make its way through the system? What are the courts supposed to do? I've got a little sheet here, just marked yes, meaning these are some things that the system is supposed to do. First and foremost, it's supposed to figure out what happened. That's the easiest way to put it. The problem with that is that the question of what happened is a little more complicated than we initially think. When someone says to you what happened, or what happened to you this morning at 10, or what happened to you last night, if you want to answer them at all, you usually relate a series of historical facts. And usually you relate actions, either your own actions, or the actions of other people, or the actions of natural forces. Well, I was there when a tree fell in front of me. But when the criminal law wants to know what happened, it also wants to know things like, what were people thinking when it happened? In fact, typically what separates a crime from what we call a civil wrong is that that criminal action is accompanied by a very bad mental state. Usually, you all know from watching criminal trials that you have to prove that the defendant intended to do something. And serious crimes usually are associated with intentional crimes. That's a lot trickier. It's one thing to tell whether Bob hit Bill, and quite a different thing to tell whether Bob hit Bill on purpose. Okay? How do we go about determining that? Sometimes it's fairly complicated. Sometimes it's not so complicated. I think most of us in everyday life have a pretty good sense for determining whether people are doing things to us on purpose or whether they're doing it accidentally. Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, even a dog knows the difference between being kicked and being stepped on. There's some sense in which the dog can dope that out, and the dog hasn't had any psychiatry courses. He can't read your mind. But to the extent that what you're thinking is manifest in what you do, and that's pretty much how we get at it. We don't get many cases where we have a direct window into the defendant's thinking. Sometimes we do. Sometimes the defendant tells us, I meant to kill. But a lot of times we have to infer that from the actions. Secondly, then, the system has to determine what is the appropriate system response. That is, once we determine what happened, then how should the system react to that? That decision is shared by a lot of people. It's shared by the legislature, who in the first instance write down what the potential penalties are for different crimes, by the jury, who after all can nullify any penalty by simply making a finding of not guilty, and by the judge, who classically is the person who engages in what's called sentencing. That is, within a range of things that the legislature tells us we can do, should it be at the top of that range, at the middle, at the bottom, and why? Now, two things that the system is not designed to do. The first one is, how do we make the victim whole? The criminal system, you may have noticed, pays very little attention to victims. And most people view that as a fault of the system. And perhaps it is, but it's not a fault that the system is engaging in by accident. It's simply not set up to do much about the victim side of the question. There's a whole other set of processes called the tort system, and we'll talk a little bit about those later this week, which is really designed to get at the question of how can we compensate the victim? How can we make the victim whole for all of this? What the criminal system is really concerned about, and all it's concerned about, is what is the punishability of this person called the defendant? How are we to respond to that person? And in a criminal case, what's the name of every criminal case you've ever seen? What's the name of the f- first party that you name?
The state.
The state, yeah. The people, in some states, they label it the people of. California says the people of California. Most states say the state of. And so, at least in theory, the victim of crime is everybody. And so when we talk about victims of crime, we always have to be careful to talk about the formal victim, which is the state or the people, and the discrete victim, which is the person who was hurt by this particular behavior. Often people say, you know, the criminal process just doesn't help the victim at all. It doesn't pay any attention to the victim. It doesn't care about the victim. Well, doesn't care about is a strong word, but is not designed to do much for the victim, is the truth. We can see that being played out now in the civil suits that are coming out of the OJ incident, right? The criminal system took one look at it from the standpoint of what happened, and if convicted, what would be the appropriate response. They determined, and we'll talk about that in a minute, that there wasn't proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But now the system that's designed to help the discrete victims is working its way through, and maybe part of what you don't like about either system is how long it takes. Okay. If you thought the OJ trial took a long time, and it did take a long time as trials go, but if you think it took a long time to get from the incident to a decision, in most metropolitan areas in this country, the average time from incident to decision in a civil case, that is to get money to the victim, if that case goes to trial, is 8 years. So criminal cases move much faster. Typically, they get to trial within 6 months. Now, the OJ case didn't get there that fast because it was a much more complicated set of investigations that had to take place. The other thing that the system doesn't do very well, and this is kind of an issue that I'm working on now, and I'm not terribly sure about this, but I want some of your help on it. What larger lesson should the decision stand for? Now, here's a process that's basically set up to figure out what happened on a particular individual occasion. But when the press gets a hold, and when a lot of us get a hold of it, we want to take that case, and let's take OJ's case, did OJ Simpson kill these two named people? Right? And we want to turn it into the following things. And these are some of the lessons that we were either going to learn or not learn, and I've garnered these from various newspaper accounts and commentators. Can an African-American man get a fair trial? Now, this case is supposed to give us the answer to this question. The implicit premise behind all of that is if he's convicted, it proves he can't. And if he's acquitted, it proves he can. Can a rich celebrity buy justice? And, you know, my main response to that is if you can't buy justice, it's one of the only things I can think of that you can't buy. You can certainly buy better medical care. You can certainly buy better care of a lot of other types. You can buy more Coca-Cola with more money. So why is it astounding to people that at some level, at least, justice can be purchased? What is there about saying justice can be purchased I'm not saying it shouldn't offend people. It should offend people. I'm wondering, however, why it surprises them or astounds them.
Well, it's not justice that you get.
Okay.
If he bought himself off when he was guilty, that's not justice.
Okay, yeah, that's a good point. Let's change the terminology. Can you buy an outcome, or can you buy a result, buy an acquittal? Yeah. Let's come back to that. But that's a good point. I should buy justice is kind of the cheap shorthand way of saying it, but by a particular outcome. Will another spouse abuser beat the system? Many, many editorials that said this trial will determine what our attitude is about women generally, about battered women, about the men who batter them, right? Now, if you're a juror, it seems to me already, and we haven't even gotten halfway through the list, already you're going crazy. Because you were put together to decide, you know, did A kill B and C? And now people are telling you, no, that's not really what this is about. The real lessons that we're going to get from this trial are larger lessons. Will the racial composition of the jury drive the outcome? And my response to that is, when hasn't it in this country? Right? Can you get a fair trial when the trial is covered on television? Television has a wonderful knack of turning all issues into issues about itself. And so a lot of the commentary was about the commentary. In fact, my favorite part of the O.J. Simpson trial are the commentators. Greta was my absolute favorite, but some of the others were okay, who would come on night after night and make predictions that proved within a day to be wrong. And it did not daunt them a whit. They just came on the next night and made another series of wrong predictions as to what the lawyers would do, what the judge would do, and anything else. I think that it's peculiarly an American phenomenon that all of our largest social issues eventually become part of a trial. That is, that a court trial, for some reason, is the way we take the major social issues and frame them and have people go after each other. And notice how awkward a vehicle is, because a trial, unfortunately, is laden down with these awful things called facts. Facts of the particular case. Right? So whether or not a rich person can buy an outcome, or whether or not an African American can get a fair trial, if those are the issues you want to address in the trial, it's very awkward, because the system isn't set up to do that. Most countries fight those questions out in different forums, and they leave lawsuits to kind of decide whether Bill hit Bob, because that's what lawsuits do very well. They're not very good at sorting out major social and political questions, because the people with the best information aren't there, and the structures aren't set up to get all the necessary information about. Let me stop talking and see where what you want to talk about, where you want to head with this. Yes, sir.
Well, I came because I've lost faith in the justice system. I've been called 5 times to jury duty, and I served the first 3 times. Mm-hmm. And the fourth time, I told the judge that I'd lost faith in the justice system. He said, why? For one thing, I told him the very week before, a man had been convicted of killing a young boy in Everett, his stepson or something. The jury decided that he was guilty. There was 60 or 80 bruises on him. And the appeals court reversed the decision because the jury didn't say which blow killed him. Now, if that's not ridiculous, I'll eat my shirt. They didn't say which blow killed him, and it was 2-1 that the verdict was reversed. That was a famous trial, too.
I'll eat one of the sleeves on your shirt along with you. I mean, with that much information, I can tell you that that's a kind of a nonsensical holding.
Well, the judge said,
let me just say this. One of the problems is how you get the information about what happened and about what the court said is almost always filtered through the press. They're not particularly good at reporting exactly what the basis of the holding was. If that's what the holding was, I agree.
The judge said to me, we don't always agree with the appeals courts either.
Right.
And that's disgusting, because here a jury sits. Why should a person sit on a jury, determine that a person is guilty of murder and should be sentenced to death, and then I have an appeals court reverse it? You're better off not being on the jury and risk that fellow coming, like one guy in Everett killed the witnesses and stuff.
Well, what happens after that conviction is reversed by the appeals court? What do you imagine happens next?
Well, it depends on whether they have a new trial or not.
But the point is, they can. The point is, it's not just they reverse it and that's the end of the case and he walks away. When there's a reversal after a conviction, ordinarily what happens, the appellate court tells the trial court what went wrong, what the problem was. And in this case, there was something wrong with the way the jury specified the outcome, apparently. Then that case is retried. often the same result then obtains a second time around. Do you know for a fact how that came down when it was tried a second time?
No, I don't. I should, okay. But I don't.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, but I mean, that's...
It doesn't seem to me it was ever tried a second time, but I can't... because I can't remember that he was. I was so disgusted.
Well, another thing to keep in mind is roughly 90% of felony cases get settled. That is, they're negotiated, the prosecutor and the defense counsel and the judge agree to a particular outcome, and the defendant, of course. And often that happens even after an appeal and a reversal. You know, by this point, the defendant has a different vision of how good his case is. Okay? He looks the first time to the jury.
Right.
And he kind of knows that appellate decision is on what might be a relatively technical point, which may not repeat itself at the second trial anyway. So at this point, he may be more willing to enter into an agreement. That's certainly possible, as what happened in this case. But you don't know. I mean, the press reports what it chooses to report. And it would much rather report what appears to be a nonsensical appellate court decision than what happened later when it was...
And another thing, you'd think the judges weren't part of the population the way they stall cases. When you have to try a man within 60 days, unless both sides agree that you don't have to,
right.
Why don't they have to appeal it within 60 days to get these appeals over with? I happen to be for the death penalty, and I think it's ridiculous the way the judges handle that.
Well, the Supreme Court's agreeing with you. They just handed down a decision last week that's going to speed up that process by cutting down the number of appeals in death row cases.
I have one more point.
By the way, you ordinarily do have to appeal within 60 days. That's a pretty common.
Well, that's
if you're talking about getting the decision in the case, that involves briefing it and reading the briefs and having the conferences. That typically takes 6 months.
Well, it takes 12 years when you're trying to get the carrying out of a death penalty.
Well, let me ask you this question. If the amount of time seems long to you, how long would it seem to someone who's in prison waiting for
He's trying to extend it every minute.
Sometimes? Sometimes?
Campbell, of course.
Oh, in death row cases. I'm talking about in non-death row cases. Then the delay is not really working for the defendant.
But another thing, the Supreme Court makes decisions that shouldn't be made in a democracy. It's the same as the old King method. They decide things that our legislature won't decide.
Yeah. Yeah. I object to that. Strongly object to that. You know, the minority has some rights in the Supreme Court should be taking up from that minority. I don't want majority rule without rights for the minority.
Well, and that's the idea of the Bill of Rights. I mean, that's where
the Bill of Rights. That's what the Supreme Court is supposed to be protected.
He agrees with you on that.
On that point, that the majority had, but when they make decisions that the legislature refuses to pass, that's haywire.
Well, it certainly isn't British.
It's not
because they do it just the opposite way. But that was that goes back to the whole Marbury problem, which is an early constitutional law case that solved that. Yeah, Jan?
This maybe is that same kind of question about whether it's British or something else, but one of the things that fascinates me about the system that we have is to wonder how much it's predicated on working in a group of people who know each other, and yet we try to make it based on not knowing each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that whole notion of a jury of your peers seems, at least by one construal of that term, that the jury should be made up of people who have a clue about who you might be and why you might have acted that way and whether or not you meant to hit somebody.
Right.
And instead, it works in part by the way it's inputted and in part by the kind of society we now have, that precisely what they try and do is get people who don't know you.
Don't know anything about you
or why you would act in a particular way.
Well,
and am I then asking the system to do something it's not supposed to do, or I guess I'm asking about objectivity and connection in the system.
The system currently has a little of both. The requirement of a jury is that it be drawn from the state and district where the defendant is to be tried.
Right.
So we get the notion that they are locals. Okay.
Right.
And we get a further notion now, a much later 20th century notion, that the jury has to be drawn from a fair cross-section of that community.
Right.
Thus, a lot of decisions about racial mixture and gender balance on juries, et cetera, et cetera. Certain limit to that, I mean, a 17-year-old does not get a jury filled with 17-year-olds, right? So jury appears now to mean more locale than it means anything else.
Which may or may not be relevant to,
correct.
To who you are and what's going on.
Correct. If we go back to the point where juries and witnesses were the same people, and that was the early idea, the people who knew the most about the case were the people who were going to sit in judgment on the case. In fact, at one time, there was a system that Britain had called wager of law. This is kind of fun to talk about. The defendant could either try the case in the ordinary way, or he could wage his law. And what wage his law meant was this. If he could get 12 people, and it was 12 free men in those days, 12 voters. If they would all come in, and 12 of them would swear that he did not do it, he was acquitted. Now, what kind of culture makes that possible? Well, you had to swear your oath before God. So if this is a culture where everybody is very concerned about swearing a false oath, and believes that a false oath is going to... I guess at worst damn them and at best cause them some mild problems when they get where they're going, right? That system worked very well. And generally it worked that if you weren't an honest person, you couldn't get 12 people to come in. Now, imagine this system today, in our culture. I'd put that in there. So what we tend to do is the jury system itself could be the whole... subject of a week's worth of talk, it seems to me that we do a very odd thing there. And that is we require those people who know the least about what's going on. If they know any of the participants, certainly if they know the defendant, even if they know the defendant's lawyer, if they know the judge, if they know the bailiff, we'd like to get them out there because they could be biased in one way or another. And you know what the attorneys tell you when they're going to pick you as a juror? They say, you know what we're doing? We're looking for 12 impartial people. And you know what? It's a lie. This lawyer's looking for 12 people who are biased in that direction. This lawyer is looking for 12 people who are biased in that direction. The net effect may be to get a kind of an impartial jury, if by impartial you mean a nice mix of prejudices.
Yeah.
And you know, prejudice is just a bad word for what your thoughts and values are. And you know, it doesn't seem to me that we want. I mean, we could make 12 machines who would be sort of value free and be totally objective, if that's possible. Is that what we want on the jury? The other thing we do with juries. Let me ask you this: if you had an important question to decide. Should I vacation at the ocean or in the mountains? And there's some debate about this. You say, I know what I'll do, is I'll hire one person to argue the ocean side of the question. I'll hire another person to argue the mountain side of the question. I'll restrict severely what kind of evidence they can use. Certain kind of things that most of us deal with every day, like hearsay, we won't let them use that. So we'll stylize the way they have to gather the evidence and tell us about it. And then I will get 12 people who know nothing about me, the ocean, or the mountain to listen and make a decision. If you go way back, especially in criminal cases, this doesn't work so well in civil cases, but in criminal cases, you'll find that the true purpose of the jury is not really to decide questions. Because, as I just, I think, demonstrated, there are better ways to decide questions. The reason that jury system sits there is because of a generalized fear of government. And the jury, since the jury has to convict, that's one sort of wall against oppression. That is, the sovereign can't come in and just, if they don't like you politically, you don't have to go back in history, just look around the world today at systems where most of the prisoners are political prisoners. Their only crime being the people in power don't like them for whatever reason. And if you, the whole idea of the jury system was to make that less possible. We used to say to make that impossible, but I think it's fair to say to make it less possible. And that's where the grand jury comes from, too. But yeah, the jury is just a... I think we're really kind of just confused about what the jury does. Most of the rules of evidence, which are rules of keeping this out, don't letting them hear this, are based on notions that were developed when the jury was basically illiterate and could and didn't have the education to handle the information. Why those rules have continued is a story all by itself.
Isn't that the same kind of debate about genetic testing? That kind of evidence that's genetic, that the average jury member doesn't have enough scientific understanding to parse out what it really means.
Yeah, and when you get into scientific evidence, you really get into an area where you are likely to get a lot of jury malfunction. Because first of all, the science is beyond most of them, right? Because it's beyond us, right? If you're not in that field, it's beyond us. And so they get the science interpreted through, quote, expert witnesses. And you get the distinction between what the writers are now calling good science and junk science. The forensic scientists, the people who make the best witnesses, tend to have the worst science. Why? Because what does a good scientist say most of the time? He says, she says, I don't know. I need more data. No way to tell. Well, that's what lawyers call a bad witness. So what you want is what we call saxophone players. Saxophone players is the term for someone who'll come in and will play a tune as an expert witness. And they are very definite. Oh, yes, touching a yellow pad of paper will cause cancer. We proved it in our laboratory. Any questions? And, you know, any questions, nothing but questions. Whereas the other side of the question, so, yeah, when you get science involved, you have this other problem. How do you deliver the science to the jury? How do you make sure that the bad scientist or the junk scientist doesn't look a whole lot better? And they do. They're smooth. They're good. They've done this before. For some of them, they've done nothing but this before. They don't do science. They do testify, right? So, yeah, that complicates it. That complicates it even more. One of the ways that the law tries to police that is by requiring that a field of expertise can't even be the subject of evidence until it rises to a certain level of acceptance within the scientific community. That's what's kept polygraphs out of evidence in almost every state. The scientific community itself doesn't agree upon what's going on there, and thus it hasn't gotten enough acceptance there. But when it does, and DNA, of course, was one of the main reasons that case took so long, and that whole process is mostly misunderstood. For those of us who know a little bit about it, know that it was mostly misportrayed to the jury anyway. I'll give you just one fact about DNA testing. We heard a lot of numbers, big numbers. 12 million, there's a chance that someone else could have left this blood, 1 in 12 million, then we heard 1 in 22 million, and then we got up into the billions. The FBI will tell you this, that laboratory error, no matter how good you are, is roughly 0.1%, which means any number that goes past 999 to 1 is a wrong number, because 1 out of 1,000 is just the laboratory error. So, a number of writers say we ought not let the witnesses ever give a number in DNA testing past it's 999 to 1 likely that this is who the sample came from, because that's the level of lab error. that you can't correct for. But there's another thing that get back there and then up here.
Could you talk a little bit about the first question? I mean, I think part of the disenchantment with the system is the fact that there is so much protection for the criminal and the victim is left. And I know the other night on public television, there was a discussion that Lawrence Krauss from Harvard said, well, he's always opposed constitutional amendments. He's finally come to the point where he has said, because the Constitution provides for protection of the criminal, of the accused, we need to now amend that and apply equal protection to the victim. And we're seeing that now in Oklahoma, where the victims can't even go to the trial.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that idea?
Yeah.
Of victim?
Let me start by saying,
I think that we need to amend, whether it be the Constitution or whatever.
Let me start by saying Larry Tribe is running for the Supreme Court of the United States. And so some of his positions are changing a little from when he was just a law teacher. He's now a celebrity and running for the Supreme Court. So
what do we do about?
Yeah. Well,
do we need to?
I think we need to do more and to focus more on how to help victims of crime. My only point is what we call the criminal justice system is not the place to do it. It's not set up to do it. It confounds the question. If you try to put in the same trial, is this person punishable? And what do we do to make this person whole? You will really drive the jury crazy because they have two questions. Think of this. You can get some cases in which the person's behavior is not very bad, might only be careless, and the injury is extraordinarily hard. Or you could get a case where the person really tried to do great damage to the person, but luckily did very little. Okay? You can't correct for that in one case, so what I think we need to do is to build up other systems that work on the victim side. What are some of them? Well, the tort system is the chief one. Okay? That is the same as a car accident system. Right? That is, you get in an accident, the person who hurt you, either intentionally or carelessly, is made to pay. What are the problems? Well, one of the problems are the people who tend to deliver harm of the type that the criminal justice system looks at are often what lawyers call very bad defendants, which is to say, they don't have any money. Okay? You can get a judgment against them, and the system is going to enable you to get a judgment against them. I mean, look at O.J.'s case. O.J. is what lawyers call a good defendant. Okay? But most of the time, when you get a serious violent crime, the ordinary way the victim can get recovery or get money is out of the defendant. That person has no money and has no and is not insured for this kind of behavior either. In those few places where you can, most of the time you can't insure against this kind of behavior. All right. So what do we do about it? A lot of states are setting up victim compensation funds. That is, they're socializing the problem. They're trying to find a way. You know, how do you fund that? That's another question. Where does the money come from to fund it? A couple of states in the Midwest are now trying a new tack on it, and it goes this way. In a tort case, you can get what are called compensatory damages. That is, that pays you to make you whole. That pays for your injury. Okay? The best we can in terms of having money do that, and we know that that's always not as good as making the person whole, really. And what are called punitive damages. Punitive damages are assessed against the defendant to really get the defendant's attention. That used to go to the plaintiff as a kind of a windfall. What the Midwest is now trying is that a certain percentage of that, it varies by state, will go into a fund. And that fund, which will be managed by the state, and a lot of people have a problem with that because, you know, the state has not always proved to be as good as the private sector in managing things, but sometimes it is. And the state will pay victims that make application of this fund. So that's another possibility. How do other countries handle it? Mostly by a form of social insurance. That is, victims of crime are handled the same way victims of any other kind of calamity are. This is paid for out of the general public treasury by way of what we usually call a New Zealand plan, because that was the first country where that plan was put together. Do you have any other suggestions? Places to look? These are the kind of ones that are being looked at now. The tort system is the classic one. The problem is the tort system usually fails in these cases because the defendant doesn't have the money.
I just know that in dealing with like domestic violence cases, oftentimes the victim is made to feel like, you know, by the time the attorney finishes with them, they've been abused all over again. And it just feels wrong.
Right.
And in fact, I know that in King County, Seattle, many of the domestic violence cases they're moving forward, they don't even have the victim in the courtroom, and they're getting more convictions when the victim's not there. So maybe there's some cases where the movement towards deleting the victim, I don't know what, but they just seem to get reabused in the system.
Okay, that's a different angle. That is, does the criminal justice system, the way it's set up, amount to a second abuse of the victim? That is, does the process work in such a way that they are re-stigmatized, re-victimized as we go through it? I guess the answer to that is that happens in an awful lot of cases. It's a real problem. States are trying to do things to alleviate that. What you run up against there, of course, are a lot of rights of the defendant then, which and you get those really tough questions. That's where the constitutional thing comes in, and that's what Larry Tribe is really talking about. Can we find a way to reinterpret what we understand? Let me give you a concrete example. The Sixth Amendment says that every defendant is entitled to have confrontation of witnesses. Okay? That means a lot of things. It certainly means that the defendant's lawyer gets to ask questions of the witness. But it also, the Supreme Court tells us, means something else. It means that to confront the witness means to look at the witness when the witness is giving the testimony, and to make sure that the witness can see you. Confront, I don't know if we have any Latin scholars here, but is made up of con, against, and frons, forehead. So confront literally means face to face. So now you have a victim of a violent crime. And in order to give the defendant his rights under the Sixth Amendment, you have to set up the courtroom in such a way that when the victim's testifying, the defendant can see him or her, and he or she can see the defendant. Well, there are an awful lot of victim witnesses for whom this is a terrible experience. They would be happy to give the testimony if they could give it on videotape, if they could be in another room. The lawyers can still go ahead and ask them all the questions they want over electronic devices. But they don't have to look at the person who hurt them at the time. Right? Up till now, the Supreme Court has said, we're not going to allow that in the ordinary case. If you can show some special circumstances, at this point, that usually consists of very young children witnesses, where they have permitted the child to be protected by being taken out of the environment where they see the offender. Okay? One state, their way of dealing with that is to set up the courtroom in such a way that the child cannot see the defendant, but that the defendant can see the child. And then whether or not the child is told the defendant can see him or her is left to the discretion of the lawyer. I frankly wouldn't want to make that decision as a lawyer. That seems to me to be an awful, tragic kind of choice. But the reality of it may be that's the only way you'll ever get the testimony.
Is the non-payment or the non-compensation to victims a relatively modern event? A kind of like, because it seems to me that there are all kinds of laws about if you do this, there's a payback system in all kinds of primitive societies.
Absolutely.
But then the assumption is that you probably know that person. Again, with Deanne, there's something to be gained by a smaller community in which you know that person. You say you're going to pay this back.
Absolutely, except we don't live in one.
Yeah, I know.
We do here, actually. And I don't know what is does Holden have a system?
A little guilt.
Yeah.
This garbology, you have to sift the butt cans.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to extend this metaphor more than it goes, but this community is a very, very homogeneous community. Many, many things. Just look around. See how homogeneous it is in terms also of people's values and what they hold dear. In that kind of system, it's probably almost true that you don't need a criminal law. That a criminal law becomes almost surplus in that kind of a system, because the community takes care of it itself in a very natural and organic way. That's why whenever you see crime statistics or hear things that this happens like this in another country, that's almost a non-starter for the criminal justice system. Because the fact that something works in Great Britain won't begin to tell you whether it will work here. Because the cultures are so different. It's a very hard thing to study criminal statistics, but you really can't study them across cultures without having all kind of fallout to it. Yes, sir. This young lady's had her hand up, and then we'll come down to you.
Okay. Well, I was starting to think that the best way for victim protection is crime prevention. Mm-hmm. And being Christian people here, or people of faith, how do we begin to address crime prevention? What are we doing? You know, we're talking about in other cultures, there's this sense that people have something to give you if you are a victim. Well, in this culture, a lot of people don't have anything to give. We're in a culture that highly prizes money and status, and we have afforded only a few people in this culture that money and status. So how do we talk more about crime prevention, what we can do for those in our society that might be thinking that crime is a good idea?
Places are trying. Frank, can you you don't have to. Can you do a minute on the way the drug court is looking at the question differently than the other system in terms of prevention?
In Camden County, New Jersey, one of the things that's going on right now is if a person's on probation and is as a result of a drug charge, and the person has another dirty urine or is found to be with drugs or caught using or buying, automatically that probation would be suspended and the person would be, at that point, sent to prison. So what's new right now is that there's an item called drug court. And what happens in that case is the person now has to report every week to an actual court setting. The different hook here is that all the treatment providers that this person has come in contact with are going to be there, and they're going to be advising the judge. In other words, where a guy could play a game where his drug counselor would not know, his therapist would know this, and the other person would know something else, he could weave in between and escape the entire system. And now, as a result of a need, what's going on is everybody's got the same data. This guy is between the rock and the hard place. And the really neat thing is that a man will come in and they'll take a urine sample from him, and sometimes the judge will require him to come in for a urine sample every day. And when he turns in a urine sample that's negative for any kind of CDS, controlled dangerous substance, at that point the entire court will applaud. And the key thing that's happening is there's something inside this guy that's starting to turn over, because he's getting positive recognition for something that's a positive behavior at this point. And I'm involved with that, and I'm really excited because I think this thing is very positive. It, you know, we're not going to be able to mandate morality. We're not going to be able to mandate, you know, a cure. We're going to have to treat these people. They do have a disease. And this disease is one that's progressive, and it's going to at some point take them killing themselves or killing somebody else. So here's a court system that's doing something, you know, in a positive
right.
way.
Thank you. Well, one way.
A couple of studies have been done about real-time or intervention, and mm-hmm. in terms of before they get there. And in the
right.
island of Kauai, they took every child born there in like 1966 and followed them 30 years to find out those who came from real high-risk dysfunctional homes that. And how many went into the criminal justice system and how many basically. And the key factor they found that those who went and led moderately normal lives, like most of us are sort of moderately normal,
right.
That the key factor was that there was a singular adult in their life that they could relate to. Whether it was a neighbor or a relative or a church counselor or a teacher, there was an adult who cared about them. that they could role model, and that was one of the primary factors. So right. when you asked your question over here about what the Christian community can do, if we just find a singular child and role model them, we contributed significantly to crime prevention.
This conversation is fascinating, the way it's evolving from what the court, what we think the court can do and what it really can do, to what the community can do in terms of prevention, moving away from the court. But my original question was going to be, have we involved the courts in doing things that they originally were not meant to do? And that's why we're so angry with the justice system. I mean, you know, the sensational cases like OJ, but I'm thinking of child custody, child protection, medical malpractice, those kinds of things. We're asking people to make decisions about drug abusers and repeat offenders. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of morality involved with that. And we've asked, and the three strikes are out in California, which is raising a huge issue now. We're all looking at that again. This guy stole a pizza, and he goes to jail for life. So perhaps we have asked the courts to do more than they ever should have done, and now we're very angry with it. I'm very angry with it. Right. But it's probably my responsibility, I guess, for asking them to do it.
Well, I mean, the criminal justice system has a lot of faults, and the court system that drives the cases has a lot of faults, but it also is a very convenient whipping boy for a lot of shortcomings of society generally, and I think some of our expectations of it are unrealistic. A system which is principally put together as a way of resolving discrete disputes is not a very good system for solving social programs generally. If we go back to the prevention question, let me start by saying I don't know all the things we can do, but the writers tend to put them into three categories. You can prevent crime or you can lower its level by either A, increasing the penalty if you get caught, B, increasing the likelihood of getting caught, or C, getting people to be the kind of people who don't want to engage in that behavior.
Or D, decriminalizing the action.
Absolutely. In fact, I could eradicate all crime tomorrow. Because the formal cause of all crime is the criminal law, if there wasn't any. And in fact, I think you're absolutely right. There are a lot of situations where decriminalizing behavior is the first step to getting it under better control. One thing the criminal justice system is awkward and cumbersome, and it takes a long time, and it's expensive. I think we'd go a long way if we'd get a lot of stuff out of that system. And people for years and years have said, let's leave the criminal justice system there for the violent offenses, and let's create a different way of reacting to what we now call willing victim crimes or victimless crimes. When I grew up in the 50s, we just called it vice. Right? Gambling, prostitution, drugs. And I can tell you this, gambling, prostitution, drugs. Okay. Over 50% of the resources of the criminal justice system are aimed at those.
Is that all?
Over 50%.
It's only 50%.
It's over 50.
Over
50. I don't know where. It's probably approaching more like 60 now.
Yeah.
Why? Well, for one thing, most crimes have victims or other people who are in a position to report it. Okay. These crimes, there is no one who is inclined to report it, which means what? If you want to get at it, if you want to police it, you have to engage in very aggressive police techniques. You have to have infiltrators. You have to have ways of penetrating wires and all this other stuff. So it's a very inefficient thing to have to police. When we think of the police, you know, how does information get into the criminal justice system? All right. We're all jaded by television, I think. Hill Street Blues, NYPD Blue, all of these, we think, oh, here's how it works. The police go out and they find the crime. Okay? Let me tell you, if you really want to know how it works, watch Barney Miller reruns. Okay? That's a whole lot more realistic than this other stuff, because the way crime works is it comes to the police. It comes to the police because people report it. because they're victimized by it or because they saw it happen. Well, that's one of the reasons that I'm real concerned about what's the level of public confidence in the criminal justice system. Because if that level of confidence falls to a certain point, then the system has to break down because the system relies on the general public for its intake.
Do you have any statistics on conviction rates? You know, we talk about victim rights.
Sure.
And my guess is you've got about a 90% conviction rate.
You've got, for felony cases, what you basically see in almost every jurisdiction is that roughly 90% of the cases will be disposed of without a trial, usually on a plea to the charge or a plea to a lesser charge. Of the 10% that's remaining, about 80% of those result in conviction.
So you got about a 2% defense rate.
Right, right.
So as far as convictions are concerned, it's a fairly efficient system.
Yeah, in fact, one of the interesting things I try to work the law students through this is to put together two ideas. 98% of the people who are arrested are guilty. That's an empirical proposition. We presume that everyone is innocent until proven guilty. That's a philosophical position.
Yeah.
Right? How do they work together? But I'll tell you, I'll guarantee you this, if you had the philosophy everyone is presumed guilty until proved innocent, then about 90% of the people who are arrested would be innocent. Take a look at a totalitarian system. So the philosophy sort of drives the opposite in terms of the way the empirics work.
I know enough prosecutors who feel in the trying a case, they don't want to get in the way of a presumption of guilt.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I used to work for a prosecutor, and you know, the judge would say, you can't get the picture of the body in there, and you know, somebody in the office would say, how can we win these cases if we can't inflame the jury? that was our attitude. That was what our job was. You know, to get them very upset at what happened. Yeah. Jeff?
I'm interested in lots of things here, but just the thing that you said about what used to be called the 50s vice struck me as important, because it seems to me that one of the things that's happened over the last 40 years is that we've taken a lot of this behavior out of the realm of morality or ethics and into some other more abstract objective.
Right.
Kind of problem, and as you said several times, there are cultural problems behind the criminal problems that we face. It seems to me that that's one of the cultural problems, that we're no longer comfortable with the language of ethics in the society.
I think that's right, and you know, vocabulary is such a key. Look at some of the vocabulary. What we used to call vice was called, you ready for this? Victimless crimes. For a long time, that was the label, victimless crimes. Drugs, prostitution, gambling. Victimless? You kidding? Then it would turn into willing victim crimes, because victimless wasn't there. Well, the answer to that is some of them were willing and some of them were not in those situations. But yeah, the vocabulary is real telling, and it tends to become more neutral as time goes on, less charged with morality. When we get about halfway through the criminal law course, I will, in some context, for the first time, utter a word in class that absolutely stuns them, and you can actually hear pencils drop, and it's the word sin. Whoa, sin. We're in law school, you know. Can you kind of clean it up a little? I mean, that's, you know. That's just not a word that they deal with.
Well, I don't even mind.
Huh?
See, you asked a question a while back, which is the first time I ever heard it put to me or to anybody, and that was, where do you think you'd get the money to help the victim? Mm-hmm. And I've got a thought for you to ponder. And that is, they say it costs from $20,000 to $40,000 a year to keep a person in jail. And give the victim an opportunity to let that person out early enough to pay them for what they lost.
Oh, in other words,
that whatever it costs to keep that man in, let him out early enough.
And then pay that money to the victim. That's interesting. It has a lot of unintended consequences, too. There was a debate, and you'll probably think that I'm making this up, but there was a debate. California came this close, and of course, if any state was going to do this, it would be California, right? As we know. Came this close to passing a law about 10 years ago that went this way. If someone spends time in jail, and then we find out that that person had not committed a crime, so they spent a little time wrongly in jail, and some of it's pretrial, they would have a credit for that amount of time against the next crime. You know, that would settle a lot of disputes early, right? You're mad at me, I'm mad at you. I have 6 months' time. That's right.
Just a quick response to this gentleman about repaying back. Mm-hmm. I don't remember what state it was, and I recently read it where they are advocating putting their prisoners on a work program and mm-hmm. paying them and giving mm-hmm. them enough money to right. put to pay back the victim and enough to put into the bank account right. for themselves.
Right.
Well, the state of Washington as of July. It's happening, but it doesn't. Well, the money is going from the inmate to the fund.
Mm-hmm.
The inmate doesn't see the personality of the thing. I mean, it's not going to a particular victim. It's
right.
He sees it as the system trying to rip him off. So, yeah,
there's something else that we're doing in Indiana, and it's had some success, and it's very different from anything we've talked about. It's called VORP, Victim Offender Reconciliation Program. In certain cases, with both the consent of the victim and the offender, part of the process is they sit down and talk to each other. And the victim sort of finds out what it is to be an offender and what was driving the offender. And the offender finds out firsthand what kind of hurt has actually been caused. And the interesting thing that the people who are running this program say is that for many of the offenders, it didn't occur to them that they were causing hurt to other people. It wasn't in their world. And when they're forced to look at it, something really, really happens. They've got to be real careful with that, as you can imagine, but it's worked particularly well in burglary cases. Not quite so well in the violent offenses, but it has been used. It's been used in some rape situations. And it's been pretty effective. And that's another kind of crime prevention technique. Yeah.
I'd like to take this another direction, Bruce. I think one of the things that media has done, it has picked certain elements within justice, for the justice system, and
sure.
maybe brutalized the definitions involved to try to maximize their ability to sell time on air or newspaper.
Right.
And one of the things that I just being a non-legal person, I question the ethics of the people involved in the game. And I mean by that, I mean the attorney. I'm sorry that I've been you. But I'm saying,
no.
a defense attorney, I see this guy as a gunslinger. All right? This guy will say and do anything to get his game or his objective met. And at some time, I think there used to be this idea of ethics. You know, there used to be this self-limitation that says, well, I can't allow myself to do that. And now, for the sake of money or for the sake of fame or fortune or whatever, you know, those elements aren't existing anymore. It's like we divorced ourselves from any self-control.
What I would say, first of all, I would say that if lawyers are hired guns, then I, as a law professor, must be an armaments manufacturer, which is kind of troubling. A lot of lawyers do that. A lot of lawyers don't. Probably a greater percentage play it right, with the right kind of ethics. The press has a way, however, of finding the bad ones and giving us more. It's the same way they have on, and this was your point before. Would you guess that there are more innocent people who get convicted, or more guilty people who get acquitted?
Oh, and that's a good question to end on.
Yes.
So we can all go to dinner.
Thinking about that. Thank you.